Session number 4808, reel 5.
Mr. Golding, reel 5.
Yes, so that was a very depressing period. We didn't have any work to do, or very little, so we were left, and there was very little entertainment of any sort, so we were left more or less becoming very introvert and very concerned. We were supposed, we did talk at this stage about release, because there was some talk in the wind that, and it was quite obvious that there was going to be some sort of invasion, because the main job which was being done was digging trenches as defence for the Japanese. And the story was, I don't know with what truth, that we were going to be put in between the Japanese defence line and the likely invasion spots, which did nothing to help morale. At this stage, actually, my own personal health deteriorated in the sense that I was losing something like a kilo a week, which was quite a lot because I was already only about 6 stone. I was a biggish person. So I was very unhappy during this period. But then, whenever the date was, we heard news about the atom bomb dropping. And this had two sort of effects. One was delight that this is going to shorten the war, but also a little bit of apprehension as to what the reaction's going to be. Strangely enough, there appeared to be no reaction at all. Certainly no guards ever said or did anything to me or behaved in any different way or to anybody I know about. I don't know if you've had any different information, but it seems to have been a non-event there. But then came the day when we heard that the war was over, which I took as usual as a little bit of rumour. But then I sort of, some of my more reliable sources said no, it was true. And then we were officially told it was true through our own people. One of the things which became very obvious to start with was the fact that there were no Japanese guards, they were instead Indian guards who were, do you know something called the IJA? The
Indian National Army.
INA, yes, right. And anyway, I can't remember the man's name, there was somebody who
Bose.
Says, Bose, that's right, yes. But they took over duties of guard. So that was pretty significant in itself. But the main thing was, though, that we did then learn that the emperor himself had been on the radio, and which, in fact, impressed the guards much more than news of dropping the atom bomb that the emperor had spoken. But then we had this horrible hiccup that Count Taroki, who was in charge there, refused to surrender. He said he hadn't seen the emperor, and he didn't believe that the emperor's words on the radio, that it was the emperor. And curious enough, I did actually see this myself, though I didn't know the significance of it at the time. There was a little aeroplane flying over, a white aeroplane, which turned out afterwards, read about it, that it contained the emperor's brother or brother-in-law, relative anyway, who came to tell Taroki in person that he'd got to surrender. And that was it. But this is an interesting part, because to show you how close that a mental and a physical conditions are, that I started putting on weight. Now, in fact, the amount of food dropped because the Japanese are sort of collapsing like that, and chaos apparently in Singapore itself, though I never went out to see it. We didn't get any rations at all for a time. In fact, we were getting less than we were getting when we were prisoners. But nevertheless, the sort of feeling of relief that practically everybody started putting on weight. The only problem was, of course, that there were the sort of the feelings that, oh God, I mustn't die now, because there were one or two people who died and thought, having gone through all that, just to die at that stage was too appalling. So there was... sleeping was very difficult. People sort of adrenaline had started to fly again, and but on the other hand, weakness was such that you couldn't sort of do much about it. You know, I had no desire to go out into the town and see what was what, because the effort, physical effort of walking, was just too much, and this applied to practically everybody. So one of the things, again, referring to these hostages, that people have said that, you know, there's no sort of great cheering from them, they're sort of taking it all very calmly. I think this is what surprised the people who did appear when we were in Singapore, that not only were we not sort of overjoyed to see them, but the general drift of the remarks was, what kept you? And they were rather put off us, actually, rather quickly, because they reach at best coldness, at worst active hostility. That because, again, this is strange, the enemy had ceased to be Japan now, had ceased to be the Dutch or the Australians or any of the others. It was anybody who had too much flesh on their chest. If you couldn't see a man's ribs, he was an enemy. And this remained with me for, I would say at a rough guess, 2 or 3 months after I got home. I didn't like anybody around the place because they must have been up to some no good if they had that much flesh on them. I hadn't realised that was going to happen until the people arrived. And then there's also the other strange thing about the Japanese guards is that, despite all the things they were doing at the end, that I found, that this is a personal thing, because what I can gather from you know, the things that you get from this FIPO business, they don't feel the same way. But I found that a sort of affinity, as if we were all caught up in the same thing. And I sort of found it difficult to tell who was prisoner and who was captain at the end. And I felt that we were all undergoing this one experience which somebody had set upon us, and really I felt no anger or bitterness at all towards them, which is not suggesting that I feel that I'm a great Christian virtue or anything, but it just is a statement of truth. Whereas on my first evening home, they'd sent us down to Horsham Way for a medical check, and then allowed to come up, and I got outside the station. I live in Victoria Station, I live in West Hampstead, and I'm taxiing West Hampstead, and he said, don't go that far, it's too far to go. And the next thing I knew, I was being dragged off him. Apparently I got his throat in my hands and I was strangling the poor devil. Apparently there was a rule then that over 5 miles they didn't have to take it because of the petrol shortage. It suddenly occurred to me that having come all this way, that he couldn't go 5 miles. So I'm not saying that about the Japanese out of virtue, but it seemed to me that we were all victims of one fate that had set us down there, apart from anything else which was going on. And it was almost as if we were acting out our parts, you know, as roles had been set for us, and this was it. So I couldn't really feel, and I have never really felt any great bitterness in that sense. I see them more as, I feel much more bitterness against Fuji than I do against the guards there for undercutting our film.
Against the Fuji?
Well, I work for Kodak.
Oh, I see.
But
You said that you had this particular feeling towards the guards, but did any of your fellow POWs want to take revenge on them?
I have not where I was, though I have heard since that the Australians who were left in Palembang did, in fact, sort of start hanging a few. Well, I've heard of some, like Sonny, who was hanged, and there were two or three others who deserved it, and I know of, and I think who were, in fact, either punished or hanged. But and I feel no feelings of sorry or pity. But, you know, to me, this was a total experience, and you had to have some who were captors and some who were captives. And I felt in the end that they were just as much belonged to us as we belonged to them, in a curious sort of way which I can't explain any more clearly than that. It's just a feeling.
When you got back to Britain, what was the attitude towards you and other returning fee pals?
Well, I think it was good. One of the things, I thought it was acceptable. Obviously, family were very pleased and so on, but on the other hand, I felt very restless. It wasn't the magnificent, you know, I suppose one's bound to spend quite a lot of time when you've got so much time on your hands thinking about all the different ways it might end and how the marvellous scenes and the happinesses which would happen when you got free. But disappeared very rapidly. I mean, one of the things, incidentally, which I should have put, which I think is of interest to you, is that pin-ups as such disappeared. It's very interesting that in the areas I was, that after about 6 months, all sexual urges died. That must have been just sheer physical, I imagine. But it happened with everybody, as far as I can make out. Now, but it was substituted in pin-ups with pin-ups of food, and, you know, there were quite a lot of glossy magazines around early on, and people would cut out the a cake and pin it up in the way that pinned up pin-ups, you know, of Betty Grable's or whatever in the beforehand.
It wasn't a form of self-torture?
Well, yes, in a way, it was, yeah, but nevertheless, and also, most of the talk was always about food. However much you sort of started off by talking about politics, religion, or anything else you want to argue about, you know, half your mind was on food, and half of it, and in the end, you sort of dropped all pretense and started talking about food. It became very dominant, and the amount of you'd wake up in the morning, I didn't have pillows, but I used my old mosquito net as a pillow, and it'd be saturated with saliva from that. But relating that to afterwards, I mean, one thought of all the marvellous things I was going to have, but when I got home, I found I couldn't. On the way home, I ate and ate and ate. I put on about 3 or 4 stone in the few weeks to get home, and then all of a sudden, it disappeared. I couldn't get through a meal. I'd eat a couple of mouthfuls. Now, that must have been psychological then. I don't know whether that was sort of guilt feelings or what, but it got quite serious, and then suddenly I settled down to normal.
Have you found that your period of imprisonment has had any long-term effects on you, either physically or otherwise?
Well, it's very hard to say. On the whole, I would have said no. In terms of physical, I've had quite a lot of things happen, but nothing which I think can trace back to that. I had my thyroid problems, and then thyroid problems, probably what that did, so the doctors say, may have hastened it a bit. Had prostate problems, which may have hastened a bit, but on the whole, I wouldn't have thought it had that effect. psychological problems, who knows? It might have been beforehand. It's hard to say. I think I would probably have been more ambitious if that hadn't happened, because it seems to me being alive is an end in itself, and the trappings of power or whatever are very much overrated compared with the actual being.
You mean it's made you more appreciative of ordinary things?
More appreciative of the very basic fact of being alive. And that, there's plenty of good in that. But I would hesitate to say without the control, I don't know quite what I'd have been if I hadn't. But on the whole, I don't flap about very much. I get a fairly peaceful type person there, so that may have been something to do with that.